Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has experienced teams who can craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex. Real wealth requires real solutions. Connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com.
The FT.
Welcome to World Weekly. I'm Sean Donnan.
It was, I think, one of the most sort of shocking and, you know, striking sights that I've ever seen. The sheer scale of the destruction in Rica's Antakata. The town far inland had been turned basically into a sea of debris. It's the sort of sight that will stay with me forever.
1 year ago, a devastating earthquake measuring 9 on the Richter scale rocked Japan's northeast, triggering a tsunami that brought widespread devastation and left some 20,000 dead. The resulting nuclear crisis at Fukushima Daiichi power plant led to a large-scale evacuation. As the victims of the quake struggle to regain some normality a year on, the great rebuilding of the Northeast is also underway. Joining me down the line from Rikuzen Takata in Japan in the afflicted area is Muir Dickey, the FT's Tokyo bureau chief, and here in the studio is former Tokyo correspondent Lindsay Whip. The two of them were some of the first reporters on the ground after the disaster. Muir, why don't we start with you? You guys both traveled very quickly to the Northeast. Why don't you just remember for us what those first few days were like?
Well, it was quite an odyssey getting to the Northeast coast. And in fact, when we started to get to the edges of the real disaster zone in northern Ibaraki Prefecture, we were then told to turn around and head south because of the explosion at Fukushima Daiichi nuclear plant. So we had to go back, basically back to Tokyo, and then fly to Yamagata on the other side of the island. And then Lindsay drove across a very long way. And so at the end of the day on the Sunday, we got to Rikuzen Takata. And it was, I think, one of the most sort of shocking and, you know, striking sights that I've ever seen. The sheer scale of the destruction in Rikuzen Takata. The town far inland had been turned basically into a sea of debris. It's the sort of sight that will stay with me forever.
Lindsay, what do you remember from that day?
When we arrived in Rikuzen Takata, it was that sort of shock because we had been driving quite high up, and so when we dropped down, there was this immediate impact, seeing this mass destruction. And it was quite difficult for the brain. The brain was desperately searching for something to make sense of, and you couldn't because there was nothing there to make sense of. Also, you're sort of looking around, and it was getting to dusk, and everything seemed so meaningless because it doesn't make sense anymore. Everything was just inert.
Who was the first person you came across when you got to Rikuzen Takata? Muir?
It was interesting. We were actually stopped as we dropped down towards Rikuzen Takata city by some volunteer firemen who had heard another tsunami announcement, and so were stopping all the traffic from going towards the town. And while we were waiting to be allowed to continue, we met a person who worked at the sake brewery in Rikuzen Takata. And he gave a very graphic description of what he'd seen. He had barely escaped with his life, and the brewery was destroyed. So anyway, he was telling me things. I remember taking notes and wondering about some of the details. Things, for example, the waves seemed to smoke as it came smashing in through the brewery, and smoke and steam coming off the top of it. And he said, as he was saying it, he obviously couldn't quite understand how that could be, but it was what he'd seen. And then, of course, afterwards, we saw some of the videos that survivors had taken, and indeed in many places the flume of spray, and in some place burning things and smoke coming off them. And it was just one of those other kind of sights that he will certainly never forget that. And he was able to give us actually quite an accurate picture of what it had been like. You hear it and then you see it, and I've been up to the disaster zone a dozen times, I guess, since then, and every time you look at these concrete buildings that have been scoured right through and some of them destroyed, and the whole flat area that used to be blocks of wooden houses, things like buses just turned into mangled wrecks and steel poles bent down to the ground by the force of the water. The sheer power of it is something you never quite get used to.
Muir, I asked you who the first person you ran into on that trip was. Who's the most memorable character you've run into over the past year?
That would be very hard to say, because there are lots of people who really shown just extraordinary, I would say, grace in the face. face of absolutely unspeakable loss. One person that sticks in memory, just an example, a very nice guy that that we met, and he was actually trying to get, the transport was very difficult, so we gave him a lift. When he realised that we were trying to find things and there were things we needed for our stories, he was very helpful with that. It was clear from the start that he was very concerned about our welfare and our work, whereas to me, you know, what he had... He'd just lost family members. He just lost his mother, and he couldn't find her, and it was a terrible situation for him. But he was dealing with that with dignity and looking around and seeking to help other people. And I was very struck by that. I just hope that, you know, if disaster ever comes to me, that I can deal with it with half of the stoicism and the grace that people have shown up here. I was very moved, I think, by the way that people in general and individuals like him in particular dealt with it.
Lindsay, is there one character that sticks out for you?
One of them was probably the family that I met when I went up a month afterwards, and I was in a small town called Ogawa, which was just in Miyagi Prefecture, and they'd lost their daughter to the tsunami. But this town was 5 kilometres inland on the river, and the next tsunami had swept up the river and basically destroyed the entire school and the pupils and the teachers. And there was about of 104 students, there was probably 74 that had been killed. And this family was just absolutely devastated, and it just really struck me the difficulty with dealing with something like this when A, there's no one really to blame, so there was no way of getting through it. And we spent the 2 minutes, there was a commemoration, so you do a 2 minute silence, and I was in the family's house there, and it was the first time I'd seen anyone break down and cry, and that was a month on.
Now, Muir, you, as you say, you've done a dozen trips up there in the past year. What is the difference that you see on the ground now?
Across most of Tohoku, the northeast, you know, life is very much back to normal, and it was quite a while ago, with the exception of the areas around Fukushima. And you know, there's radiation there, but I would say it's only a threat or even a potential threat for people who are living in the area long term. For visitors, it's fine. But, you know, you can visit, you could enjoy yourself. I've taken my family to Tohoku for a number of holidays since then. It's in general, life across the region is pretty much back to normal. Along the devastated communities and the coast, though, it's still very, very far from normal. And I think there's recovery. People have, relief has happened, and basically people are housed, and basically people can live. But actually restoring many of these communities to anything like normality is going to take an extremely long time. And the last couple of days I've been on one side depressed just by the recognition of the scale of the challenge ahead of people and the great sadness that's still, you know, across many of these communities, but also inspired because around the edges of towns like Rikuzen-Takata that were completely, almost completely gutted, there is a lot of work being done. A lot of people are restarting businesses, shops are opening in prefab houses, fishermen. I met a seaweed farmer today who'd brought in the first crop of seaweed, first harvest of seaweed, sorry, since the disaster, and another who got his first boat, a new boat, 2 or 3 days ago, and they're delighted to be able to work and to restart. But for everybody, it's in these coastal communities, it's still, everybody knows it's a long, long road ahead of them.
Muir spoke earlier to one of the survivors of the quake, Makoto Chida. He's a 37-year-old oyster farmer in Rikuzen-Takata.
I'm an oyster farmer in Rikuzen-Takata. Each of my family members had a different job, but they were all safe. 3 of my boats and all of the 800 rafts were drifted away. I lost everything. But I am 37 years old and still young, so I never thought about quitting my job. Instead, I thought about starting over from scratch. The oyster farming has recovered to a third of the previous level. I'm working every day, hoping to have 100% recovery by next year or the year after. Oysters from the Hirota Bay are traded at the highest prices in Japan. I will keep working hard for those people who have a delight in oysters.
Muir, you also recently went back into the exclusion zone with a family and have written very movingly about it for our weekend magazine. Just tell us a little bit more about that zone and what remains a no-go area for most Japanese.
It's a essentially an area that's been put around the planet. It's been tweaked now. At the beginning, it was a simple radius. Now they're gradually trying to restrict access only to the areas with the highest levels of contamination. And in fact, some communities are starting to move back to towns on the edge of the zone. But you know, for people whose homes are in those exclusion areas, and there's also essentially a voluntary evacuation area, which is beyond the exclusion zone, but which also pretty much now depopulated. You know, for people whose homes are in those areas, it's an extremely difficult situation because some of them, I think, understand that it's likely to be decades before they're allowed to go back, and in many cases never will be. And if they're farmers, it may not be possible in their lifetimes to farm their fields again. But they don't know, and radiation risk itself is highly contested. Many people would say that, many scientists would say that worry about radiation has spread much, much more widely than it needs to have. But other people, other experts and scientists argue that, in fact, the risk could be quite high for long-term health of staying in these areas. So, you know, for people, for ordinary people who don't have a science background and a strong opinion, it's very difficult to know what to believe. The anxiety levels are extremely high and the social stress and disruption is extraordinary.
Lindsay, a year on, what is going to be the legacy of all this?
Well, I think there will be several, but one that I would like to point out is probably the impact on the demographics of Japan. It almost feels like that the Northeast is sort of a microcosm of what's happening in Japan demographically. When we would go into the evacuation centres, that it would feel like the majority of the people, even though it wasn't the majority, it would be a good sort of 30%, were over 65 to 70. That's huge. So it's so accelerated in the North. And so people who were already leaving to work in Tokyo and other large cities, that's only going to be accelerated by this tsunami, the legacy of the tsunami, if the government doesn't work hard enough to get regeneration happening in a way that keeps young people in that area. And then on the psychological front, the government has been doing work with children and old age pensioners. There are a few groups who have been concerned about preschool children and how to deal with the trauma and the shock of the earthquake and the tsunami. They've been through sort of play therapy in order to try and help them deal with the situation. But then when you go to the likes of sort of Fukushima, where you've also got the radiation concerns, one of the therapists that I was speaking to in that prefecture was saying that the families and mothers face a huge quandary about whether to let their children play outside or not. And if they didn't let them play outside, then there had been already effects of the children not having enough sunlight and enough exercise, and so they were catching colds quicker. But then if they did let them outside, they felt worried about whether they were then responsible for giving their children exposure to radiation. And that's not going to go away for the rest of their lives, probably. And that's a huge worry.
Mir?
Well, I think there'll be a lot of different legacies. There's some of them good, some of them bad. The outpouring of volunteerism, tens of thousands of volunteers rushing to the Northeast and many still here working very hard, has been, I think, an inspiration to society, and that will have long term effects. Less positively, the loss of trust, as I mentioned before, connected with the nuclear crisis and its handling, I think, will also have effects. What they are, it'd be very hard to chart at this moment. But I think many people last year, immediately after the disaster, thought or hoped that in itself it would kind of be a turning point for the nation, and that would galvanize Japanese politics and society to kind of break out of something of a funk. It's easy to overstate, but Japan has been in something of a funk for quite a while, and sort of give the country its energy back, maybe in the way that defeat in the Second World War actually became the start of the economic miracle and this extraordinary success that Japan then later enjoyed. I think those kind of hopes may be overdone. It hasn't wiped the slate clean. It's terribly big, but in many people in Japan, as I say, life has gone back to normal. They don't have to change things, and it's still a very successful country, and things are difficult to change. But I do think it's very important that Japan make a success to the maximum possible of reconstruction. I think it will. Failure in Northeast will sap confidence in the country. It will have great human cost. And whereas success in creating new sustainable communities will, as if you can tackle a declining demographic and a rapidly aging society here in the Northeast, then you can do it nationwide. And if you can do it nationwide, it will be an example for the world.
And that's it for this week. My thanks to Lindsay Whip in London and Muir Dickey down the line from the affected area, Enrico Zentakata. World Weekly was produced by Serena Tarling. Till next week, goodbye.
For more downloads, go to ft.com/podcasts.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has experienced teams who can craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex. Real wealth requires real solutions. Connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com.
Join Capital Group CEO Mike Gitlin for a new edition of the Capital Ideas Podcast. In unscripted conversations with investment professionals, you'll hear real stories about successes and lessons learned, informed by decades of investment experience. It's your look inside one of the world's largest asset managers. New episodes are available monthly. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Invest 30 minutes in an episode today. Published by American Funds Distributors, Inc.